This is the current federal tax developments for the week of May the 22nd, 2017, brought to you by the Lascalzo Institute. Current federal tax developments is brought to you both by the Lascalzo Institute and by your State Society of CPAs, who sponsor live courses to help you fulfill your CPE requirements. This week's K courses, relying on the outside auditor. That's going to be our issue. We'll take a look at a number of developments during the week. We'll start with a case that talks about a divorce agreement that was found not to control the results in an innocent spouse case. We'll talk about issues of dealing with potential tax refunds when you're filing the 8 years of return for a taxpayer who has entered the offshore voluntary disclosure program. We'll also talk about how does a taxpayer inform the IRS of information regarding a listed transaction if no Form 8886 was filed with the original tax return and an audit gets underway. And finally, we'll talk about a case where the officers of a corporation were found to have reasonably relied on the outside auditors in assuming that the payroll taxes had been paid, even though they had evidence previously that their controller had a few problems. It's season again for us to get ready to do all this fun tax and CPE work in the tax area. And for those of you here in Arizona, we're also coming up on the early sign-up date for continuing education. I want to remind you that I'm going to be doing a few courses early in the CPE season here in June here in Arizona. In the Phoenix area, I'll be doing courses at the ASCPA offices. Now, for those of you who are not aware, so you don't waste time climbing stairs here shortly, the society will be moving, my understanding is, in the coming week to new offices downstairs just to the right as you enter the building, if you've been down there before. But if you don't want to deal with that, these courses will also be webcast. So if you just want to sit in your office and take them, that'll work for you too. On June the 12th, I'll be doing a course, Real Estate Partnerships, Get In, Get Out, Get Taxed. That'll talk to you about both partnership problems that we have, things like the new partnership audit rules, and issues that deal with other partnership items, like when you put in appreciated property into a partnership, as real estate partnerships often have happened. And we'll also talk to you about some of the basic real estate issues, including issues related to the 2014 capitalization regulations and how that impacts real estate. The following day, on the 13th, I'll do a pair of four-hour courses. We'll be doing the morning course. We'll be dealing with accountancy ethics. So those of you who need your 4 hours of ethics coursework for the year, you can pick that up here on June the 13th. That'll be in the morning. The afternoon that day, we'll do the Arizona Income Tax Update and Review. That afternoon, I'll head to Tucson. In Tucson, we'll be at the DoubleTree by Hilton at the Williams Center. This is a new location for CPE down in Tucson. So we'll be at the DoubleTree on East Broadway. So you know where we'll be at this time. Don't go to the where we were last year. We're now moved, so be aware of where we're going. And we'll also take a look down there then. Our course there is going to be on June the 14th, Assisting the Survivors of the Decedent's Estate. This course will talk about various tax issues that a CPA gets involved in, actually tax and to some extent accounting issues we get involved in. We talk about an estate for a decedent. We'll also have a discussion there of the Arizona Uniform Principal and Income Act. So we'll talk about how that applies to things. Now, this particular one will not be webcast. So if you want to take that course, you're going to have to come to the DoubleTree in Tucson and, you know, attend the course live. But we look forward to you. Be sure you consider those courses as you're signing up here at the end of May. Gives you something to do. It is June. It's nice to have somebody else pay for the air conditioning, so you can sit in and watch your courses there, either in Phoenix or on the 14th in Tucson. Let's take a look at the developments this week now. We're going to start out, our first case we're going to start out with deals with innocent spouse relief. Under Section 6015 of the Internal Revenue Code, spouses who file a joint return, as we know, normally that's joint and several liability. But if certain situations are met, spouses can be relieved of some or all of the liability on the tax return. And that was the case here. We were looking in this case about a couple who had gone through a tax exam, and the tax exam had come up with taxes due. The taxes were due to rental properties. that the couple had owned, and the IRS was disallowing deductions. But these properties, some were owned by one of the spouses, some were owned by the others. And oh, by the way, in the interim, the two spouses had gotten divorced. So in this case, what we end up doing is taking a look. Our case is the case of Assad and Akel versus Commissioner. This is a tax court memorandum decision 2017-80 that was issued on May the 15th. Since each of them had their own rental properties, they asked for innocent spouse relief. Normally, under 6015, we could do that because, you know, to the extent the income is allocable, in this case, to the specific spouse, we are, you know, the code will allow in many circumstances for us to divide that liability based on how much is applicable or should be assigned each spouse. The IRS was not disagreeing that these two that each of them qualified for instant spouse relief, so neither of them should be required to foot the entire bill. But the IRS disagreed with what the taxpayers claimed should be the way this should be divided. Like a lot of divorce decrees, their divorce decree provided that each spouse was equally liable for any additional taxes assessed on a joint return year. And they had decided that's what they liked, and they had each agreed that it should be a 50-50 split, and they were asking the court to provide for that split. Now, again, the IRS did not disagree that they should get innocent spouse relief, but the IRS said, hey, wait a second, should not be 50-50. The law doesn't provide for that, and we think we're being disadvantaged if you go that way. The IRS won in this case. The tax court sided with them. 6015 only allows that division based on each party's share of the income. And based on that division, based on share of the income in this case, it had to be divided in a different. In this particular case, the division was going to be a bit biased. Recall the bottom line, it was like a 28-72% split. Now, the couple says, but wait, our decree says we're each liable for half. As the court kind of points out, well, the spouse that gets a 72% tax due, assuming they pay that 72%, has a right to recover from the other spouse, but that's under state law. The IRS has the right to get 72% of the tax from the spouse that had the larger number of rental properties. The IRS belief, and it's a reasonable one, is if it becomes 50-50, then the spouse with 28%, there may not be enough assets to collect the 50% from that spouse. And the other spouse gets off scot-free because, in essence, not scot-free, but they get rid of 22% of what should be their liability, their holding assets. So the IRS has the right to go 72-28, and then it's up to the parties in state court. This is not a surprising result. Again, a party that is not, anybody who is not a party to the divorce decree, the IRS was not. Generally, you're not going to be able to bind them with your decree. The IRS never agreed to the decree. So because of that, the IRS does not have to live with this 50-50 split. That's confusing to our clients, but it's basically what you've got to expect. There's only so much that can be done in a divorce agreement, and a lot of it has to be enforced at the state level. Next, we're going to consider the IRS's Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Program. Now, you may remember this program. It was created in 2009, still exists. It allows a method for taxpayers who, oh, by the way, might have forgotten about that foreign bank account that they had, and they hadn't been reporting income from that on their tax return. Now, under the terms of the Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Program, if you come into that program, you get away with lower penalties than you would otherwise, but you have to file amended returns for the prior 8 years, the last 8 years, whose due dates have already passed at the time you enter the program, and you have to give the IRS the right to collect tax. If there's any tax due for those years, you have to agree you'll pay it, even though you're past the statute of limitations for those taxes to be paid for some of those years. Well, here's where things get interesting. You're doing 8 years. It's possible one of the 8 years might show a refund. Chief Counsel Advice 2017-19026, issued on May the 12th, deals with the issue of what should the IRS do in a case like that. The situation is you're filing 8 years of return, and one of those years happens to show a refund. In the example the IRS gives, which you'll find written up in the PDF you can download from our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com by going to the weekly updates and getting this week, May 22nd's entry, you'll find on that full entry, you'll find at the very end of that the right to download the PDF. In this case, the IRS said, let's take a fact pattern where somebody enters and the 8 years in question were 2003 through 2010. In the tax years 2003 through 27 and 2009 and 2010, there were underpayments of tax. But in 2008, there was a large loss. That results in an overpayment for the tax year. The IRS agent reviews the return, agrees there's a refund due for 2008. The question becomes, what's the impact of that refund? Now, of course, the taxpayer wants that offset against the taxes due from the other years. The question is, can the IRS, can or must the IRS allow for that offset? Well, this ruling decides that we have to look at the regular rules for allowing a claim for refund. And generally, the real takeaway here is, remember you agreed to pay tax for all 8 years? Well, we're going to find out that that does not mean that you also, that the IRS agreed to give you a refund for those years. Rather, this ruling concludes you must qualify, that refund must qualify as an allowable claim for refund under the normal statutes. That is, had you filed that claim for refund at the time that you entered the program or when you provide the amended return, then we could go ahead and we can take that refund and offset. But if you didn't enter the, you know, if you would not have been allowed a refund by filing an amended return at that time, then merely the fact that you agreed to let the IRS get tax for the other years doesn't allow you to get that refund. The example they use, they talk about a 2008 return. They said, okay, if a taxpayer entered the program in March of 2012, there's a really good chance, remember, 9 year, you know, would have been due in 2009, April 15th of 2009. You enter in March 2012, you're within the 3 year statute. That is available. If on the other hand, though, they entered on March 2014, it's less likely that return was filed within the 3 year period. It's still possible certain facts could bring you within the 3 year period or the 2 year tax payment period, but likely it's not there. Now, you might also get that one where you extended the statute. Generally, if you extend the statute, you extend the right for claim of refund. But the IRS takes the position that that extension of the statute has to be an extension, not a reopening. In essence, the years you merely agreed to allow the IRS to collect the tax, that's different than extending. If the statute was still open on 2008, when you agreed to extend the statute, and that is, we're still open for assessment, and the IRS now has not, and we discover a refund, then you can use that refund. But if you merely told the IRS it's okay to collect the tax from 2008, even though the statute was already closed, you're probably out of luck. So that's not going to make sense to a lot of your clients. But again, please remember, the Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Program is just that, voluntary. And if you come into it, you have to meet the requirements of the service. And the service says, you know what? This is how we view this is working. Could somebody challenge it? I assume possible. Would they win? Well, that's a whole different question. Next up, we're going to talk now about listed transactions and disclosure form. We're all aware there are nasty penalties for failing to disclose a listed transaction on your tax return. They're not as nasty as they used to be, but they're still fairly bad. 75% of the tax reduction, minimum penalty of $5,000. Again, we do have caps on those, but it still can be a fairly nasty thing. And by the way, it's a reduction of tax claimed on the return due to the transaction. If you fail to attach the 8886 to the return, then the statute stays open essentially until the IRS is later informed under Section 6501(c)(10A). The secretary must be furnished the information so required. At that point, a one-year statute will begin to run if we're not, you know, if we're already outside the three-year statute for normal assessment. And the question here is going to become, how do we furnish that information to the IRS? This is the case of May versus United States, Ninth Circuit case, case number 15-16599, issued on May the 16th of 2017. During the exam in question, the IRS became aware there's no 8886 on the return. And at some point in the exam, the agent became aware of the information. Basically, if you take a look at all the information the agent had, he became aware at some point during the exam that all that information that would have been on the 8886 was within his possession. More than 1 year after the date, so we can take a look, he attempted to assess the penalty on a date. It was clear 1 year prior to that date, he had all the information that would have been on the 8886, even though it wasn't actually presented to him on an 8886. Now the question becomes, was his assessment of the penalty timely? Could he actually go after the penalty, or was the IRS blocked by the statute of limitations? Now this was a split decision. The majority of the panel said that the requirement to furnish the information so required, it has to be done in accordance with the statute. The statute says that the information shall be furnished in the form specified by the secretary in regulations. Those regulations under 6011 require you to file the form and include the information required by such form or regulations under this. So the taxpayer, according to the majority, has to file the 8886. Even though they have provided all information to the agent, if they didn't provide it on an 8886, the statute does not begin to run. The minority opinion, the dissent, does not agree with that. While the dissent says it's not just that they could have pieced it together from various sources, that's not good enough. And the dissent even seems to imply that they probably would have agreed in this case that while the agent had all the information, it wasn't really clear that the agent had the information in a way that would have been obvious to him right away, that he, you know, aha, this is a listed transaction problem. And therefore, it may be very reasonable, the dissenting opinion said, to have concluded it still need to go back to district court because the district court had said it was too late and we need to file this, you know, we have a later filing, we need to go back and look at this. But he said it should not be taken that you have to absolutely, with no exception, file the form 8886 to get the statute running. Now, the interesting part about this is a non-published decision of the Ninth Circuit, and it's a split decision. So clearly, this is not the final word in any way, shape, or form. But what it does suggest is that if this sort of situation arises, it might be best to get an 8886 in front of the agent. Now, of course, we know the downside. The downside is, of course, you just told the agent there's a disclosure problem. But the downside of not doing it is the statute stays open. And no matter what else happens, including a failure to extend the statute otherwise, you could still be on the hook for the penalty, even if the agent had all information under their control. Interesting problem here with the 8886. And how it ends up going. Next up, well, this one probably are, you know, our friends who are on the audit side of the accounting profession will probably not be thrilled with this decision. But those of us on tax, it's like, oh, good, this kind of works for us. This is dealing with the trust fund penalties. Now, everybody should be aware, if you're in tax, that when a business has withheld payroll taxes from employees, the taxes withheld, federal withholding taxes, and the FICA withheld, are what we call trust fund taxes. Under Section 6662, anyone who is deemed to be a responsible person, which is generally a person who had the responsibility and or ability to see that those payments are made to the IRS. If those payments are not made, and that responsible person either had actual knowledge the taxes had not been paid, and they had the ability to pay the tax, that means even if it meant not paying other bills, they would have shoved the money over and paid the IRS, or that person recklessly disregarded known risks regarding failure to pay such trust fund taxes, then that person becomes personally liable for the taxes. As you might guess, we have a case here where taxes didn't get paid. This is the case of Byrne versus United States from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, case number 2:06-CV-12179. The opinion came down on May the 15th of this year. In this case, the president and the CEO, they're two separate people. So we don't have one person who is president and CEO. We have two different people. But they became aware that their controller was, shall we say, somewhat challenged in carrying out the duties of his office. They started this company, and this company was going to be providing parts to GM, and they had financing from GMAC. GMAC, as part of the finance agreement, required two things. Number one, they got to send their own people in from any firm that, from a firm they chose, to confirm that basically they were in compliance with the loan and to look at their collateral. And the firm also must provide GMAC every year with an audited financial statement prepared by an outside CPA firm. The company in this case acquired the services of a CPA firm. The CPA firm, WCD, is the reference we're going to see to it in the case. As we started the business, the CPA firm provided the controller with the forms he needed to comply with the tax law, payroll taxes, etc., and told him how to prepare and file trust fund taxes. Despite that guidance, the CPA firm telling him this stuff, he started out on a bad foot because he deposited the trust fund taxes on a biweekly as opposed to semi-weekly. So instead of depositing them twice in the, you know, at the two stops during the week, he just did it every 2 weeks. Obviously, that's not what he should have been doing. This resulted in a large penalty assessment because all of his deposits were late in early 1999. By the end of 99, the CEO and the president had decided that the controller was not adequately performing his duties. And thus, they gave the controller a handwritten list of tasks he needed to start completing accurately and timely. Now, GMAC had their first collateral review come up in March of 2000, and their auditor sent a letter to GMAC stating that the company had provided inadequate supporting documentation for their collateral review. Therefore, they recommended, among other things, that the company implement procedures to ensure all tax payments are made timely with supporting detail retained. GMAC forwarded that document because this document did not go to the company, but GMAC said, you know what, you guys need to know about this. So they forwarded the letter to the company and one of the officers reviewed it, right? And within 2 weeks, he said, you know, Mr. Fuller, take care of this. What's our problem? Well, Mr. Fuller sent a letter to GMAC acknowledging missed two trust fund deposits during their switch from Northwestern Bank to National City Bank, but he claimed they were current with all deposits, and he copied the CEO and president on the correspondence. At the same time in March of 2000, the CPA firm sent a letter to the president copying the president's CEO and copying Fuller, telling them about deficits in their accounting practices, the management letter that they had found when conducting their 1999 audit. It stated, however, that they did not discover any material weaknesses defined as conditions which Eagle Trim's internal control structure failed to reduce to relatively low level the risk that errors or frauds in amounts would be material in relation to the financial statements being audited, that could occur. So standard management letter issue. They did recommend that Eagle Trim hire an assistant controller with an accounting degree as part of that letter. So they did that, right? They hired an accountant to assist with his duties, and they even went out and hired a CFO to whom Fuller would report. Nevertheless, we still have payroll problems. The IRS issues a penalty notice for $98,622.32 in October of 2000. At this point, one of the partners from the CPA firm comes in and assists the controller in writing I didn't really mean to do it. Please, 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 you know, forgive this penalty. He said he had contacted, so the partner contacted the IRS several times about the issue, and that the IRS informed him Eagle Trim has made all trust fund deposits on full and on time since June of 2000. Following a conversation with Fuller, you know, basically, and I should say, when I say he, you know, Fuller claims he contacted the IRS. Got to get that right because it's important. And that he said they were current. The CPA didn't confirm that, but he did write a letter to the IRS, gave his explanations about why the deposits were late, we switched banks, and requesting waive the penalties. He also attached a letter, a check from Eagle Trim to pay the interest on the late trust fund taxes. And in November of 2000, the controller sent a letter to all of the parties here, basically describing the penalties, his meeting with the CPA, and the CPA's request for an abatement of the penalty. Okay. Again, the CPA firm created and issued another clean audit. They again found, you know, they said there were current payment of trust fund taxes, they reported. And despite that audit report, they found flaws in the accounting practices. They found the issues with trust fund taxes, etc. They again suggested that, you know, certain steps be taken. But they had never actually said that effectively, they had never found a significant deficiency. And the court spent a lot of time on that. Unfortunately, it turned out that the audit had uncovered certain important things. When the GMAC auditor came out in January of 2001, they found some big problems besides just that Mr. Fuller had lied about all the payroll taxes being paid. He also had a tendency to add zeros to invoices. So they found, for instance, so he had inflated receivables. An $8,000 invoice was recorded as an $80,000 receivable. At this point, GMAC was going to pull the credit. So the CEO and presidents entered into a forbearance agreement with GMAC. They hired a crisis management company. And at this point, they came in and any payments now had to be approved by the crisis management company. Okay, had complete control of the flow of money in and out. BBK, who came as a crisis management company, took a while, but they then discovered there were a large amount of unpaid payroll taxes. In fact, they informed in February of 2001, they informed the CEO and president that they were delinquent on trust fund taxes for the last three quarters of 2000. When the CEO and president asked for permission to pay those taxes, they refused to approve the expenditure. At this point, the controller is finally fired. The auditors bail at this point, say don't rely on our financials. Now, the IRS said, and the district court agreed, that you knew your controller was flaky, bad, etc. You never specifically asked the auditors to go confirm that the trust fund taxes were current. You can't rely on that. You should have known. You recklessly disregarded the risk that those taxes would not be paid. Well, the district court bought that. The Sixth Circuit said no. They said we think it's a close call, but we believe they acted properly in relying on the fact that the CPA firm who was doing the audit didn't indicate that there was any problem with the trust fund taxes. Every time they came in, they claimed the problems had been taken care of. And, you know, and the fact that they didn't confirm it, we never asked them to confirm it. Well, and the bad news for the CPA firm in this place is we see terms like this. We find nothing in the record that would cause us to question the reasonableness of the CEO and president's reliance on the CPA firm's competency. Okay, that probably makes you feel bad if you're the CPA firm. Because then it goes on, but then it says later, they had no prior indications of error or inaccuracies in the auditing firm's work. Okay, this is really sounding bad, right? And we hold the reliance on the representations, on the audit firm's representations was reasonable. As you might guess, you get a little nervous reading things like that if you're an auditor, as to the court viewed it, that essentially you had told them it was fine. The court went on to point out that neither the inside auditors, neither set of auditors, either those from GMAC or the outside auditing firm, had discovered the payroll tax problems, essentially, until there was a lot of deep digging by experts. And it wasn't until the crisis management firm came in and really got down into the weeds that they were able to truly find the problem. Based on that, the court found, even though it was a close call, because they kind of knew they had a flaky controller, they found that the CEO and president had behaved reasonably and had not recklessly disregarded the risk. They reasonably believed that the payroll taxes had been paid. As such, they don't owe a trust fund penalty. Well, it's that time of year again when we start doing CPE. Remember, go out, take a look at your state society's courses, and sign up for your live CPE right now. It's summertime, tax season finished. You got a little bit of a break here before we get to that, all that rush coming in September with now this year, the triple whammy of September 15th, September 30th, and October 15th with those extended due dates. So you might want to take a chance now, take a look, sign up for your live CPE. Certainly consider those courses brought to you by the Lascalzo Institute. Consider the other courses your state societies offer. This has been the current federal tax developments here for the week of May the 22nd. You can catch our daily updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where you also get a PDF with articles on all today's topics. You can send any questions and comments to me, Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, and you can follow me on Twitter. You'll find me there at Ed Zollers. Take care, have a good week, and we look forward to talking to you again next week on Memorial Day as we will discuss the tax developments for the coming week.